Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Clutter, hoarding, these are words that are often used interchangeably, but experts say there's a big difference between the two. Clutter can refer to disorganized piles of objects that collect over time in places meant for other uses, like tables and chairs, the floor, or staircases. You probably have clutter somewhere in your home right now. I know I do. But when clutter starts to take over common areas of the home, when the kitchen, the living room, bedroom, and other living spaces become so overcrowded with clutter that your everyday activities are difficult to carry out, this is a hallmark of hoarding disorder, a condition, if left untreated, that can affect your health and quality of life, as well as the people around you. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seawert. Today, we take a look at what causes hoarding and why it can be so difficult to recognize the problem and ask for help. We'll discuss the different stages of hoarding behavior, the causes behind the condition, symptoms to watch for, and how to effectively address the issue, which affects millions of people around the nation. During today's program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742 or email ideas at WPR.org. Marilyn Tom Forty was in the midst of a career change when assessments kept pointing to organization as a strength. She found a chapter of the National Association of Productivity and Organizing, also known as NAPO, spoke with other organizers, and ultimately found her calling. Now she's a member of the group, as well as a hoarding and chronic disorganization specialist with New Life Organizing. She helps people restore order to their lives. Marilyn, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Dr. Scott Borkenhagen is a psychiatrist with Marshfield Clinic. He practices general adult psychiatry and has completed a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry. He treats a wide variety of disorders, from depression to delusions, schizophrenia, and much more. Dr. Borkenhagen, welcome to Route 51.
Thanks for having me.
I read a statistic that said between 5 and 14 million people in the U.S. are compulsive hoarders, at least twice the number of people that are diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. The actual number is probably higher, though, because people seem really fearful or reluctant to admit that they have this kind of problem. Marilyn, why do you think hoarding is so embarrassing to reveal to outsiders?
I think there's a fear of discovery because people might... Well, there's a lot of shame involved. Might see you as dirty, lazy. You just can't get your act together. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things.
Well, so many of us have clutter. I mean, I do. And a lot of it has sentimental value. That makes it even harder to part with. So, Dr. Borkenhagen, at what point does too much clutter fall into the hoarding category?
Well, a good way to spell that out would be to just look at the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria. There are six criteria that you have to meet to be diagnosed with hoarding. The first one is the most important. They all are, though, I guess. It's persistent difficulty discarding or parting with possessions, regardless of their actual value. Number two is this perceived need to save items is causing the difficulty. And if they think about this, you know, discarding or getting rid of these possessions, it causes great distress. The accumulation of possessions is what results then, and you start to see the clutter that you're talking about. Now, what separates clutter from normal clutter from hoarding is pretty simple. The hoarding causes clinically significant distress and impairment. And so if it doesn't rise to that level, it's tough to diagnose hoarding. Two other things are kind of important in the background as well. Hoarding can't be attributable to another medical condition like a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, and it can't be better explained by another mental illness. So the obsessions of OCD, decreased energy of depression, delusions of schizophrenia, those can all result in clutter. But what differentiates the two is that the people who are hoarding are doing it intentionally. They're intentionally keeping these items And then if they think about getting rid of them, it causes great distress.
Well, people who have this disorder sometimes describe themselves as over-enthusiastic collectors. What's the difference, Scott?
The difference is that if you're a normative collector, that it's systematic, it's organized, it doesn't lead to distress, impairment, etc. So it's a fine line, because some people who collect have as much as people who hoard. But the difference is that they are happy with what they're doing and they're more organized about it.
Marilyn, you help people who are trying to get control of their lives and their homes. On TV, shows that portray hoarding show some pretty horrific conditions, things like rotting food or dirty diapers everywhere. Is that a realistic view of hoarding, or are those really just extreme cases?
It's interesting that you asked that question. I was actually on TLC Discovery Channel's Hoarding Buried Alive, mm-hmm. and I was quite nervous at the time about how they would portray the show, like what the footage would turn out to be when it went on TV. And they did an amazing job. What you saw was what happened.
Really?
They cut out a few words here and there that were extraneous, but it was exactly what happened. And so, yeah, at least TLC mm-hmm. is very, very accurate. I actually don't watch the other ones very much. But yeah, there are different levels of hoarding, and there are different types of hoarding, and there are clean hoards, and there are dirty hoards, and there are animal hoards, and there are just Amazon boxes hoards. I mean, there's a whole gamut of different situations.
Mm-hmm. Scott, why is it so difficult for people to part with their possessions? It seems like people who struggle with this, they have just deep distress when they try to discard anything. We see it on these shows. You can see it on their faces that they are so upset at the thought of letting go. Why?
That's the million-dollar question. We don't have a concrete answer to that, but we have a bunch of clues. So when we look at genetics, there's no specific gene that has been identified that leads to hoarding. But we do know that when you look at twin studies, that 36 to 50%, even 60% of the heritability is due to genetic factors. And so I think the way they spell it out is additive genetic factors, because it's a complex myriad of genes that we don't really understand yet, but we know that genetics are at least partly involved. Now, there's some anecdotal links between traumatic life events, that kind of bringing this out, but that's also unclear. When you look at the data and you really dig into it, there's not a consistent trend with traumatic events and hoarding. Sometimes retrospectively, people will report that, I had a traumatic event. After you start to get into discarding this stuff and digging into the underlying psychology of it, each patient is different. Now, one thing I guess I'd say, though, is that if I'm going to be a science nerd like I am, that one of the most exciting things I read was how people who have frontotemporal dementia and or have damage to the certain area of the frontal lobe, it's called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and then the cingulate gyrus, which if you kind of put your hand on your forehead, it's the two layers of brain right below that. And so the frontal lobe, if that becomes damaged, what we know is that it can lead to people accumulating things, excessively acquiring things that didn't do that before. And so there's some thought that these two parts of the brain are kind of modulating this subcortical drive to collect things. The theory is that we all are kind of built as hunter-gatherers, human beings, to acquire things. The difference between a normative brain and one that's affected by hoarding, though, is that this subcortical drive kind of runs amok. The environment doesn't get processed as fluidly by the person's brain, and so they kind of ignore the clutter. They're not seeing it the same way other people do.
Is there a family connection? If you have a parent who's a hoarder, are you more likely to be to have
all
that
the studies suggest that if you have anyone in your family that's a hoarder, that the likelihood of you being one is around 50%.
Is there an age that it usually begins? Is there a specific age, or does that really vary?
The pathogenesis is pretty well defined. What we know about it is that between ages 14 and 19, that you start to see some of these symptoms emerge. I think the average age, if you look at the median in all these studies, is around 17. I think it was 16.7 years. And then each decade that goes on, these people tend to worsen because the additive effects of accumulating things over the years and the stress of aging, et cetera, usually has kind of an additive effect where the patient starts to look like a hoarder in their 20s. It becomes clinically significant, typically in their 30s. And then if you look at most people in the clinical studies that are done, they're in their 50s. So you start to see people, I think, admitting it and owning it by about that time, if they're going to at all.
Marilyn, you mentioned animal hoarding, and that's something that sometimes comes up in the news. We'll hear about something where a bunch of animals have been rescued from a hoarding situation. People who hoard animals often seem to start with a genuine desire to help. How does that spiral out of control?
I think it's like Scott is saying, that it starts small and it grows, grows over time. Most of my people that I work with are very empathetic people and brilliant people, and they see a lot of good options in different objects. And the idea of rescuing a pet gives you a big dopamine burst, if you will. You know, you're doing something good, something valuable, something society admires, until you no longer are. but they're still trying to.
And but they see themselves as a saver of sorts, like they're saving these animals, and that makes them feel good.
A rescuer, yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, whether it's clothing or food or animals, whatever's being hoarded, do you think there's a sense of guilt about wasting something? Like, do they see throwing something away or giving something away as waste, Marilyn?
I think the altruism definitely falls in there. They see possibility in things. You know, an ice cream pail can be 25 different things, or it can just be an ice cream pail.
Sure, sure. I can use that.
But
I could use that for something.
25 things, man. We better keep that one, right?
I guess if you're someone who has a lot of things, you've accumulated a lot of things, like craft items, for example. I have baskets and baskets of knitting yarn that I haven't touched in 2 years. I mean, but how do you draw the line? Scott, how do you draw the line from, like, you're kind of creeping into that ooh, I've got way too much stuff. How can you effectively stop and say, okay, I need to stop doing this now?
That's a good question. And most people who have hoarding disorder can't. It's kind of like you implied before. It's this shameful kind of guilty thing that they keep a secret. Most people do not spontaneously report this. It only comes to light when they're being evicted, or their family becomes concerned, or neighbors start to complain. I've even heard stories where the city gets involved because there's just so much clutter that's apparent from the street. And so the line, it's a very fine line, I believe. But what you look for, if you're a family member, is that distress, the impairment. Are they providing a sanitary place for themselves? Are they able to take care of their normal duties? Are they able to use their kitchen and sleep in their bed? When it gets to the point of affecting their day-to-day life and limiting their social relationships, that's when you start to get a little more concerned.
You're listening to Dr. Scott Borkenhagen and Marilyn Tomporty as we continue our discussion on hoarding behaviors on Route 51. Coming up, we'll discuss conditions associated with the disorder. We'll talk about when to bring in a healthcare provider for help. Your questions are welcome, too. Give us a call at 800-780-9742. I'd like to also mention that we will have a list of resources after the program at wpr.org/Route 51. You can email us questions, ideas at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Marilyn Tomforty and Dr. Scott Borkenhagen are our guests today for a discussion on hoarding and related behavioral issues. You are welcome to join the conversation and ask your own questions. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can call us at 800-780-9742. According to Mayo Clinic, many people with hoarding disorder have other mental health conditions. Scott, you touched on this a little bit earlier. What kinds of coexisting conditions do you typically see in somebody who struggles with hoarding disorder?
Well, 75% or about that of people with hoarding disorder have a comorbid mood or anxiety disorder. If you break that down and you kind of look at what they actually are, about 31 to 37% have generalized anxiety disorder. 26 to 31% have major depressive disorder. 15 to 20% have OCD. And that's relevant because this used to be classified as a derivative or derivation of OCD in the DSM-5, which I believe came out in 2013. They reclassified it as its own disorder. And so it's not as tied to OCD as it once was, because recent research has found that most people who have hoarding disorder don't have the other symptoms of OCD. Only 15 to 20% do. And then the other ones kind of at the bottom of the list, 17% have panic, 17% have social anxiety, and 14% have PTSD. Now, these are all different disorders, but they're all kind of unified by anxiety. They're all driven by anxiety on some level.
Marilyn, can you discuss the clutter hoarding scale? You alluded to this with me. What is that?
There's an organization called it's ICD, the Institute for Challenging Disorganization. Their website is challengingdisorganization.org, and that will be in that resource list, of course. But on that website, they have a list of resources. And one of the resources they have is called the Clutter Hoarding Scale. And there are pictures that you can use to, like when Scott and I, for instance, would be working with client Sarah, we'll just say, I could tell Scott, according to the pictures, she is a level three, because the pictures show a uncluttered home all the way to a home that maybe the ceiling is falling in or windows are broken, that kind of thing. So it's a scale that you can use to roughly grade someone to facilitate conversation and facilitate the helping of the person. So a family could also use that if they're reaching out to social services or to Scott or someone saying, my mother has got this issue. Looks to me like she's a level four, at least in the bathroom, maybe a three in the living room, but definitely a five in three of the bedrooms. So it's a great tool.
And again, I want to mention that we will have a list of resources at wpr.org/route51 after the program for folks who want to refer to those kinds of tools. We have a caller with a question. Welcome to Route 51. Thanks for calling.
Hi, my name is Paul, and I'm calling from Altoona. And my question is regarding my mother and her hoarding. She didn't start hoarding until she was in her mid-50s, and that's after having a pristine household and up until then. And it started with the sudden death of my sister. And I'm wondering if addressing a person who has started this so late in life would be easier than addressing it with somebody who starts showing these signs earlier in life, like you described earlier in the program.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Paul's question was, he said that his mother began hoarding later than what you describe, after a sudden death, and wondering if it's, if it's related to that, if it's something that's perhaps easier to manage and to treat, if it's something that comes up later, or isn't there a difference? Maybe Dr. Borkenhagen, you can answer that.
Everybody, the timeline I mentioned before is very generic. It's kind of the average person with hoarding disorder. Everybody's unique, though, and the way that it develops is unique. If we look at people who have it, they all meet that diagnostic criteria, but it's not like it all comes down at once. Usually things start to kind of start early. And then the way that they're processing the world, the way that they're processing their stress gets derailed. And it begins to veer into this area where they feel like these objects have sentimental attachments. They have more value than they really do. The theory is that if you look at the psychology of this, that you start to see there are predictable traits in the people who have these issues. Indecisiveness is one. That's probably the number one trait that you look for early on in people, also in first degree relatives. So if you see a whole family of people who can't make decisions, there's a lot of red flags there in terms of hoarding. But that's a gray area. It's not easy to define. Perfectionism, avoidance, procrastination, difficulty planning and organizing, distractibility, all these contribute to the overall tone and tenor of how this hoarding develops and how it ends up looking. Now, there aren't conclusive links between traumatic events and hoarding. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means when we study it, we can't quite make that link in a definitive manner. There are a lot of reports, though, of people having a traumatic event, losing a loved one, losing a pet even, and it kind of triggers this new wave of symptoms.
There are a lot of people there are a lot of people who have this issue and they don't seek help. They're embarrassed and they avoid letting people enter their homes. That can lead to even more isolation. Marilyn, how much does that complicate matters?
Complicate matters for the client?
Yes.
The person?
Sure. I mean, the isolation of not being able to have people into the home.
Sure. It makes major problems. Sometimes when I get there, the person is washing their dishes in the bathtub or in a tote. And the reason that they're washing the dishes there is because the drain in the bottom of the kitchen sink rusted through. And it's a simple fix, right? You call a plumber and they replace that trap. But if you can't have somebody in to fix it, then you start washing your dishes somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's the same with the stove. The gas burner started spitzing and needs to be fixed. Maybe the little ports need to be cleaned out, but you can't have somebody in to fix that. So it just all spirals and builds on top of each other.
I'm curious if there's a connection between hoarding and compulsive shopping, too. And Scott, you're nodding your head. What can you say about
there
that?
There sure is.
Yeah.
The number one form of hoarding is excessive acquisition. Just below that, and so people who are just buying things on Amazon relentlessly. I hear a lot people who have excessive acquisition that they love that dopamine burst they get. It's like Christmas, you know, when they get the mail and when the object or item arrives. Sometimes they don't even have a place for it. And that's when you start to kind of worry, but the thing I guess you'd say about that is people who end up hoarding, typically it's not really attached to the value of the item. It's, a lot of things that they end up hoarding are mail, magazines, papers. There's this fear of losing information, this fear of letting something important go, that kind of prevails. And so it becomes increasingly more difficult, I think, as you commit to this or let it go. I don't know the right way to say it, but as these people snowball, it becomes increasingly more difficult to admit that this is a real issue. Now, people who steal, people who collect the more random objects like mail, old clothes, that's a little less common. What we see more commonly, especially in women, when you look at studies, even though hoarding affects men and women very equally, if you look at it overall, what we've started to see is more recently women in developed countries, at least, are kind of straying more towards this excessive acquisition. And I don't know if I have a good reason for that, but I think Amazon, eBay, all these, things that you can access right from the comfort of your home, they probably have something to do with it.
Marilyn, when you're dealing with clients who are buying all this stuff. They're acquiring all this stuff. Maybe they think it's a good deal. Maybe they just, like Scott said, they need that dopamine rush of getting something. How do you break that chain of thought?
When I'm working with a hoarding client, we have the best result when it's a triad. We've got someone like Scott working with the person in between the hoarding sessions, and then me working with them, putting into practice some of the things that Scott is teaching them as to how to make those tough decisions. And then I'm also helping them make the tough decisions. Do I want it? Do I need it? Do I have room for it? Is it paying its rent? Why do I have it? And working through the hands-on piece. But that triad is super important to heal the hoarding. It's not just something I can say, oh, quit buying. No, right. That's just not going to work. And a family can't do that either.
Right.
It's just not effective.
Right. Scott, let's talk a little bit then about how treatment happens. I've read that cognitive behavior therapy is perhaps the most well-studied method. How does that work? And is that really the primary course of treatment that you think works?
Yeah. You know, the CBT is the first line treatment for it. So there aren't medications that effectively treat this. What you do is you try to use cognitive behavioral therapy to reshape the way that they're looking at this, that they reshape the way that they're looking at themselves, what acquisition means to them. And you do this all in the context of, you know, their genetics, their family, their living situation, because this is a very, lifestyle driven issue. And if you don't involve collaterals, people who are around the patient, you're not going to get very far, typically anyway. And so what you do is you try to create a sense of support. You try to create early on in the treatment, you try to create expectations, goals that they're going to be shooting for. And then you try to be, a little bit more rigid as you move forward in, you know, making them meet those goals. And you use a motivational approach, which typically, you know, utilizes the question method, where you're just exploring what this means to them. You're getting them to kind of recognize the situation that they're in. Some people have really good insight, and people who have good insight into what's going on, they can make changes pretty readily. They can usually get a hold of it. People with poor or absent insight, who just don't admit it or can't see it, they end up spiraling into a much more dangerous place.
Again, the number to call with questions, 800-780-9742. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org if you have questions for our guests. I'm curious about group therapy and family therapy. Scott, can those be helpful as well?
Yeah, you know, the group therapy, it's not as well studied in hoarding because it's such an individual pursuit, but it does have some positive data around it. What we really know, though, is that skills training, graduated exposure, in other words, gently kind of getting these people to let go of things, gently nudging them in the right direction, that tends to be the best. And that's kind of a hallmark of CBT. For example, if you have someone who's terrified of an elevator, you don't put them right on the elevator. You have them kind of look at pictures of elevators. Then you go to one and you just touch the button and don't get in. It's the same kind of thing with hoarding. You kind of have to nudge them gently in the right direction and hope that they can start to internalize it and, you know, do it on their own.
Whether we have a loved one with a hoarding disorder or we've seen it on TV, one common theme we hear all the time is that these people don't really see it's a problem. It's their stuff. They don't think it's anybody's business but their own. But there are some physical hazards here. How does hoarding impact health and safety, Marilyn, when you're looking at people's homes? What gives you pause when you think, okay, wait, this is not a safe situation?
Sure. Just the level of bacterial infection possibilities with, you know, food, rotting food in a refrigerator, scum in a sink, animal waste, all those kinds of things. The possibility of a fall. Often there's just a little area that you sneak through in a room to try to, you know, to get to the bathroom or something.
We've seen it here. Yeah, we've seen it here in Wausau too. There was a fire a couple of years ago, a fatal fire, where the emergency responders could not get to the victim in time because of all the stuff in the home. And those kinds of things can make it really difficult too. But it's hard for the person who's collecting and hoarding to see that that's an issue. I'm curious about kids. You know, when this happens in younger years, Scott, if hoarding begins in preteen, early years, how can parents learn to cope with their child's hoarding behavior in a productive way?
That's usually why it's not diagnosed in kids, because the parents learn to compensate for them, you know, get rid of some of the clutter and kind of do the things that they can't. It's tough to diagnose in kids. Only 2% of the population, the pediatric population, is thought to have this, which is comparable, I guess, to the adult rate, which is around 2.5%. Some studies have it all the way up to 6%. But if you look at the data that we have, in fact, there was recently a meta-analysis, which means they pool the data of multiple studies. And they took 11 studies with over 1,000 participants in each one. And I think that in the adult population, it was 2.5%, and it was right around 2% in the pediatric population. So why aren't these kids being diagnosed? It's a byproduct of multiple things, partly because of the parental compensation I mentioned, but partly because this is a cumulative kind of a disease, where usually if you have support structures around you, you have organization around you, that will end up helping you to at least cover this up, you know, to a large degree. It's when people get out on their own, they're left to their own, you know, devices, that it ends up being a real issue.
And many people who hoard feel pretty resentful when they're told they need to get rid of things. I mean, they see what appears to be mostly junk to others as something that's useful or potentially worth something. In your experience, Marilyn, how can you help them clear the clutter while making sure that they still feel in control of what's happening so that they're not resenting the organizer?
That's a really tricky thing. A lot of the times when I get there, the person has had a lot of like nagging and pleading and threatening from other people around them. And so there's resentment and there's a feeling of hopelessness. They've tried to change on their own and it didn't work and they're exhausted and maybe they're ruminating about it. Distrust, because they've been hurt by people that they should be able to trust. So lots of reflective listening. Respect, don't touch it without permission, talk through it, start with the baby steps. Like Scott said, you don't put the person in the elevator right away. Mm-hmm. So go to something that has not been seen or handled for quite a while to start with and talk through it.
That's
Marilyn has a much harder job than I do.
You're listening to Dr. Scott Borkenhagen and Marilyn Tomforti on Route 51 for a discussion on hoarding when clutter takes over. Coming up, what to do if a family member is a hoarder, how to start breaking unhealthy behavior patterns, and other resources to get help. If you have a question for our guests, you're welcome to join in. Give us a call at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guests, Marilyn Tomforti and Dr. Scott Borkenhagen, as we continue our discussion on hoarding. It's a condition millions of people struggle with on a day-to-day basis. If you have questions for our guests, email us at ideas@WPR.org or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. And I do want to mention we will have a list of resources at WPR.org/Route 51 after the program. I'm curious, what are the chances that someone who hoards will overcome this permanently? Marilyn, on TV, some of the TV shows that portray hoarding situations, they seem really hopeful. A year later, they go back. The person has started all over again.
So you're asking me why they went back, or you're asking me
Do they? I mean, is there help? What are the chances that someone will overcome this permanently?
It does happen, for sure. If they're working with someone like Scott and working with an organizer, there's definitely situations where people have overcome. However, it takes years to dig out of all of it. So when you say overcome, one person's idea might be that the house is spick and span, but another person's idea might be that no more hoarding is happening and I can now walk through 8 of the 9 rooms and the 9th one is spick and span.
Sure, sure. Well, what are some ways to stay on track if you're working to address this issue? Scott, what do you tell people?
What you really want to do is identify what triggered it in the first place. How to prevent relapse is essentially, learning who the patient is, learning why they're hoarding in the first place. And once you get to that, point, you can start to refine their psychosocial situation. You try to avoid stressful triggers, stressful situations. You get their socialization increased, out back into the public, into the mix, keep an active lifestyle. You mentioned before how groups might be helpful. And usually in the maintenance treatment, that's where you really see it become helpful because there is all this resistance initially, and it's difficult. So for a patient to participate in a group, they have to kind of be on board with it and want to do it. And then you have to address any underlying medical condition and or mental health issue. If they have depression, you treat it. If they have anxiety or OCD, you treat it. And usually when you get this team approach and the patient starts to buy in and talk, the language that everyone else is, not their own language that they've kind of convinced themselves is correct. And, what I mean by that specifically is they tend to see things very differently in terms of the risk, in terms of, the cleanliness, the sanitation, differently than other people do. And so you kind of have to recruit them gently into, objectifying this. And once they start to do that and you educate them, it becomes more of a didactic pursuit. It becomes more of a, we can overcome this if we just keep learning together kind of approach.
Marilyn, when you're
I
wanted you to add to that actually and talk about how do you identify the wound that causes this? How do you address that?
Yeah, I personally, in the experience that I have with the clients that I work with, I cannot think of one that hasn't had a big wound. I know that the scientific evidence hasn't pulled that out in the numbers, but just in experience, that's definitely what I see. It could be something like autistic children that never, how do I want to put this into words, never were the ideal family that parents thought that they might be. And so there's a parent with a wound of not having that, not feeling like they left out, they were missed out in the whole parenting picture. And so maybe I will find a room full of games and kid stuff. And all of that is tied to that emotion of loss of the childhood and the idea of being a parent, being a family that they missed, right? Because of that experience of autism. Or maybe it's a parent died when the person was 14 or 15 and there's just this wound that never got a chance to be grieved. And the kid had to step up and just be strong and hold the family together and just so never healed and then built this wall of stuff to try to find out. It can act like alcohol for people. You talk about that dopamine rush, Scott.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a compensatory quality to all of it. It seems like they're usually reacting to something. Figuring out what that is the hard part.
And then grief counseling, when they do figure it out, to actually go back and work on those pieces.
What about the people who are living with a hoarder or have a family member who is a hoarder? How can family members cope when it's so hard to keep from getting frustrated? What do you tell families, Marilyn, who are so frustrated and they have no idea what to do to help?
very typically when I get there, there's already been a ton of damage done. I mean, there's been shaming, there's been humiliation, there's anger, there's wounds that have been added to wounds that added to wounds. And so there's a lot of forgiveness that needs to be done. If the family can decide to put a stop to previous wounding behavior and instead turn it into like objective descriptions, like instead of "you are a hoarder," the stuff is a hoard. Like, so take the person out of it, use positive statements and "I feel" statements rather than "why do you do this?" Change it to "I feel frustrated when I see," you know, so to take the pain out of those statements.
Scott, I'd like to ask you too, what do you tell people, what do you tell families who are so frustrated with the behavior of a loved one who's hoarding? How do you help them?
I think it goes back to psychoeducation, trying to get them to understand what's going on. Once you objectify it, it depersonalizes it on a certain level. One thing that I guess I would say, and I don't mean to be too black and white about this, but there's so much gray area that I feel like one thing that family members can do is think of the screening questions that we use when we're screening for hoarding. And all the studies out there suggest that there's just two questions that you need to ask to kind of start the conversation. One is, do you find it difficult to discard or part with a possession? And then two is, do you have a large number of possessions that congest and clutter the main rooms in your home? So family members can kind of think that through on their own and determine on their own, is this crossing the line? If it is, usually you're not going to solve it overnight. You're not going to solve it by yourself. You have to enlist this team approach and kind of get support built around the person.
So Marilyn, you're somebody who knows that a family member has a problem. And let's say the whole family talks about it. This is what happens. The whole family talks about it behind their back, and right. You know that. What do you initially say to somebody? What's the best way to approach somebody for the very first time when you know they have a problem and you want to help? What can you say without being hurtful?
An example would be like, using single words, like, "I feel really sad when I see the struggle of you trying to make a meal. I feel really worried when I see that you're only taking a sponge bath because you can't use your bathroom. I feel guilty when I'm fill in the blank." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But single words like that and "I feel" statements and taking the shame away, but being honest and expressing, being assertive, actually, but in a loving way.
Scott,
and it's easier said than done. I mean, the emotions rise so quickly.
They do, because they're, again, we talked earlier about the shame involved. The person who's hoarding is embarrassed. They feel shame. They don't want to be put on the spot about their behavior. It makes them feel defensive. So, Scott, what are some do's and don'ts when it comes to helping the person in your life who is struggling with this?
I think the biggest do is to, well, it's twofold. Try and understand what's going on with the person instead of rushing to judgment. And then try to, you know, objectify things. If you get into this emotional end of the pool with a family member or a friend, it's probably not going to go anywhere. You're probably just going to get frustrated, talk in circles. It won't solve anything. And so if you can start to kind of hold the person accountable in a gentle way, that's the best thing you can do. And then you kind of push forward with that same mindset where you're trying to get the person to gently advance to maybe clean. All right, look, we're not going to clean this whole house tonight or even over the next month, but maybe we could get your kitchen and your bathroom cleaned up. You know, maybe we could clear your bed off so you could sleep normally. And once you start to restore some of the person's humanity, it's tough for them to deny the compromise. Now, it comes back to their level of insight, though. If you have an elderly family member who maybe has dementia or the beginning stages of it, that's probably going to be a losing battle until you get some professionals on board and treat the underlying condition. And so there's no clear-cut black and white answer. But what I would say is that in any mental illness, in any psychopathology, the key is to try to understand, not to judge.
Marilyn, are there agencies that help with cleanup, or does inviting a stranger to in make it more complicated? What's easier for the person who's struggling, having family members help or helping a stranger, having a stranger come in and help with the cleanup?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. What is the family dynamic? Mm-hmm. Is it painful? Is it ruined already? If so, then a stranger might be better. But then who is the stranger? Mm-hmm. And what is their comfort level? Can you meet at a coffee shop ahead of time and develop a relationship? Ask some questions.
Mm-hmm. When somebody,
develop some trust.
When somebody finally comes forward, let's say somebody's listening right now and they're identifying these behaviors in their head and they're thinking, you know what, yes, that's me, and I know that I have a problem. Scott, what's the first step they should take to try to
reach out to someone they trust, like Marilyn's alluding to? You know, if you try to kick your own doors in and you go right to the nuclear option, you go right to a psychiatrist, you go right to inpatient care, you go right to, you know, one of that's probably going to backfire. It needs to be a treatment regimen that has a lot of buy-in. And so if somebody's recognizing this in themselves, they should try to reach out to a family member, a friend, a pastor, you know, someone in the community who they feel like they can confide in and admit some of this stuff to. Once they get to that point, then they can start to, you know, hopefully work with that person to search for resources, search for professionals. They are everywhere. When I was researching for this, I was shocked to see how many resources are actually out there. It was real easy to come up with a full list, a full page that I couldn't even get any more on if I tried. And so, you know, there are a lot of cleanup projects out there. There are a lot of people like Marilyn out there. There are a lot of clinicians in Madison area, Milwaukee area, Wausau, you know, the bigger areas where they specialize in this. It's pretty much all they do. And so once you start to push in a meaningful direction, the dominoes start to fall quickly because there's so many things out there.
Marilyn, for those of us who are collectors, people with too much clutter, maybe we haven't crossed that line into hoarding, but we have a lot of stuff. What are some easy, quick steps we can take to start to take control of that?
Start in one spot, like maybe to the right of the door, and work your way around the space. One of the things we kind of bandy around in Napo is if you want to feel better about yourself, start in your bedroom. If you want to feel better about your whole house, start in your kitchen. And then some of those basic questions: do I love it? Do I need it? Do I have room for it? Is it paying its rent or it's part of the mortgage? And why do I have it? And talk yourself through those. It might even make a sign for yourself with those questions on it. So we hold up the object and ask yourself those questions. And then it either goes out or it stays. Or you could use a decide box and box it up and come back to it in a year if you're really having a hard time with the emotions of the object. Or sometimes you can make a small piece of the emotions to remember, like maybe a dress that you had as a kid that was really cool, but it has a tear in it. Maybe you keep a little piece of the material or take a picture. Or there are other ways to save things without having the whole object.
We have about 30 seconds left, and one final question for you, Scott. What do you think is the most misunderstood aspect of hoarding, something that you really wish people would understand?
That it's people just collecting junk. It's not always that. Sometimes there are valuable items in these piles. It's not, you know, something that falls under the class of they're just collecting garbage or it's all meaningless. You know, you have to try to get in to what is happening and, you know, try to get on it today. If someone's listening to me and hears my voice, try to start the process now.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Dr. Scott Borkenhagen and Marilyn Tomford. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51. We'll also have resources there for you. You can subscribe to our podcast available from your favorite platform. And if you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back. Until then, we're heading out of town.